This episode is supported by Pop M, a unique shop located in Littleton, New Hampshire, and by New York Mutual Trading, the premier Japanese food, alcoholic beverage, and restaurant supply specialist.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum. I love to talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. Today's theme is Know Where You're From. When people ask me where I'm from, I say Brooklyn. I've lived here almost 20 years, but really I'm from a lot of places. The places we spend time throughout our lives make up who we are and where we're from. What does knowing a place mean to you? I was born in Manhattan and lived until I was 15 in Westchester County, in a mostly bedroom community where the bulk of my peers had one or both parents who, like mine, commuted daily to the rat race of New York City. They spent a lot of time in traffic or on a train, but got to live in a nice little town that was moved in the 19th century to make way for the reservoir system to feed the growing city's need for clean water. At 15, I moved to Northern California, about the same distance north of San Francisco as I'd lived north of New York City, but they were very different communities. There was no rail line, and very few people drove back and forth every day to San Francisco. Petaluma and the surrounding Sonoma County was its own economy. My high school years were spent on a skateboard, at punk shows, and at the beach, but I knew I'd return to the East Coast. California was and still is an awesome place that I love to visit, but it's not where I want to live. I returned east to New England for college and spent a lot of time in and around Massachusetts and Maine, with a short stint in Iowa for one hot summer and some tornadoes. But I love it here in the Northeast. It's not as vast as the West, and it has a much more hospitable coastline. There's plenty to see, and the West Coast is only a six-hour flight away. My guest today is an Angeleno through and through. Richard Parks III grew up in what sounds like a California fantasy. Fruit trees and avocados for days, sun and sand, and all the great things Los Angeles has to offer. He's a writer, podcast host, and was kind enough to interview me recently about my book, Vinegar Revival, when I was in LA back in May. A few weeks ago, I had the chance to return the favor, and I interviewed Richard about his life growing up in LA and why he'll probably live there forever. I have dreams of living in other countries and really getting into their cultures or moving every year and learning the ins and outs of as many towns and cities as I can. But when it comes right down to it, there's something comforting about knowing where you belong and where you feel at home. For me, that's New England. But it's also New York City, so I'm torn. Lucky for me, it's all pretty close together, and I like driving.
Having not had time to prep this episode, I'm just going to ask my guest today the questions that I normally send ahead of time, and we'll see how that sort of works out for an interview.
When you don't have a chance to write down a thoughtful email in response, or exactly. However you do it.
Yep, exactly. So, what is your name, sir?
My name is Richard Hill Parks III, but recently I've been going by Richard Parks III. Because when I recently authored a cookbook, co-authored a cookbook with a chef, upon deciding how I would label myself for the cover.
I get it. It's a big deal. I chose whether or not my middle initial was going to appear because my father is Harry Rosenblum and my grandfather was also Harry Rosenblum.
Oh, so you are in a sense a third.
Sort of. My grandfather had no middle name. My father has a different middle name than I have, and I've never gone by the moniker third, but my father has used junior.
So what did you settle on?
Just Harry Rosenblum.
Okay. Middle initial. So I've been Richard Parks for so long, but Wesley Avila, the chef and co-author of the Gorilla Tacos cookbook, turned to me and said, "Everybody's named Richard Parks." And by that point, he had been, you know, he knew I was a third, and so he'd been calling me RP3. That was his, and that's how he refers to me as that I refer to myself in that when writing his voice throughout the book.
Right.
And so, yeah, I went with Richard Parks III. But yeah, if you go by Richard Hill Parks III, you're just asking to get smacked, you know?
Yeah,
people will think I have a trust fund.
Yeah.
But I'm the third Richard Parks. It was my grandfather, and my uncle is Junior, and he is the Reverend Dr. Richard Hill Parks Jr.
Wow.
Yes. He is I believe they say Right Reverend. You know, he has a doctorate.
Okay. Yeah.
And he is an ordained minister in the Methodist Church.
Wow.
in
intense.
Outside of Cleveland, Ohio. Retired. Yeah.
Did you grow up in Cleveland?
I didn't. I grew up in Los Angeles.
All right.
But in any case, it didn't go continuously through the generations. No, I grew up in Eastern Hollywood, around Melrose and Western.
Got it.
Yeah.
So that answers the hometown question. Hometown is Los Angeles, where you still where you reside today.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I left and came back, as we all must.
Yep.
But yeah, I've been back for about 5 years. Live in Silver Lake.
Yeah.
Don't think that I could ever come back and live in New York. I think that that era has passed. That window is closed.
But you lived here, so you've
for a very short time. I never really dug in here. Felt too obvious. Everyone who I grew up with in LA,
moved to New York.
Yeah, moved. It's like, and it's
just like everyone I know from New York moved to LA.
So I went to college instead in Montreal, Canada.
Ah, very nice. Where'd you go?
McGill University.
I know it.
And then after that, was considering moving here and getting an entry level job in publishing, but instead ended up working on a documentary film and et cetera and so forth, and have lived most of my few years in California. And I don't think I will ever leave. Because it's just, I'm going to miss the farmer's market if I end up, someplace like this.
Yeah, it's true. Now it's pretty, we're getting into a good season for the farmer's market in New York.
The green market? You call it a green market?
We do. It is the New York City Green Market. In fact, was co-founded by the son of an old friend of my mom's.
Oh, really?
Helped found the original Green Market when it first started in Union Square.
When was that?
That was, my friends at Green Market are going to be mad at me if I fuck this up. I believe that was in the early 80s.
Oh, and it's several times a week, right?
Now it's several times a week. Union Square, several times a week. There's dozens of locations all over the city. There was one today in McCarran Park here in Williamsburg.
I just can't
imagine. There now are alternative, farmer's markets that are not associated with green markets. Green markets is a specific nonprofit run by the city.
I see. I didn't realize. I thought it was just a colloquialism, an idiom for farmer's market.
It is an actual body. It's an organization that runs the New York City farmer's markets.
I see.
So, I think people call it the green market. They call it the farmer's market.
Right. But I just can't imagine going to the farmer's market and
in
getting
February,
micro-celery. The
when
tubers.
When there's just it's apples.
And then getting
off
the subway with
apples.
My bag of apples and
potatoes.
Parsnips or whatever. Yeah. At some point, I feel like there was probably a romance to that. But, at this stage, I have laundry in my apartment. I got rid of the truck. I drive a Prius.
Yeah.
It's over.
But having just been in LA, so Richard and I met in LA. Richard was kind enough to interview me about my book when I was there a few weeks ago. And so now I'm returning the favor.
That's what we do. We invite each other on each other's podcasts.
Right,
no,
totally.
We had a great event at Now Serving,
yep.
The awesome cookbook store.
Yes. If you are in LA or planning to be, go to Chinatown and check out Now Serving. That actually, one of the things I wanted to ask you about Los Angeles, I find it very interesting, in cities like New York, like Los Angeles, where the food culture is changing fast or has changed, and you now have places like, Famous Ray's?
Oh, Howlin' Ray's.
Howlin' Ray's,
yeah.
Sorry. Right, Famous Ray's is the pizza places in New York. Howlin'
right.
Ray's Hot Chicken, which is in the same little mall where Now Serving is. And when I walked up, it must have had a 2.5 hour wait.
Always.
And someone told me it always has a 2.5 hour wait.
Always, yeah.
And to me, that's really, and I looked at that and I'm like, oh God, I would never do that. But then I was talking with Zach Brooks,
right.
Who runs Smorgasburg in LA. And Zach said, no, I thought the same thing. He's from Miami. He lived in New York for a long time. He's lived in LA for a couple of years. He's, constantly exploring food out there. It's his job, literally.
Yes.
And he said
he
no,
made
it
his
great.
Job even before it was something
exactly.
that he got paid for.
Indeed.
He takes it very seriously.
And, he said that standing in line for Howlin' Ray's was a great time. It was fun. He met the people in front of him.
Man,
when he got to the front
Zach
of the line.
The craziest stuff.
And I just look at that and I'm like, so that's my question for you is I feel like LA is a place where the hype, not
yeah.
that New York, but I don't know, I feel like New Yorkers are really cynical about shit like that.
Mm-hmm.
And my sense of LA is that in LA people are like, no, when you want Howlin' Ray's, you go wait in line for 2 hours.
I mean, this is interesting because I feel like it's a complicated question because, yeah, I've thought about this. I mean, for me, the answer is simple. I just don't wait in lines like that for food.
I'm with you. 100%.
Yes, I went to Hall and Ray's once at 11 in the morning before. It had the 2.5 hour line every day, but it was still somewhat buzzed, and there was something of a line. I went with my friend Tin, who writes about food, too, and we ate the spicy fried chicken sandwich, and it was great. But I'm never going to wait in a 2.5 hour line for that. Right. And I never have enough days in Austin. I've never gotten Franklin. You know, like, I'm not that guy. So that's one way to kind of address that question. But that's where personal stuff. In terms of, like, culturally, I mean, interesting thing about Far East Plaza, the place that we're talking about, we're now serving as, and there's a great restaurant called Lhasa that people love. Ramen Champ was there. And Pok Pok was there. Pok Pok opened there. And so Pok Pok, I had been to in Red Hook, here and then in Portland.
I've only ever
been
to the Portland location. I've never been to one here in New York.
Yeah. Well, yeah, so Red Hook, out of the way, kind of. You know, it's like, but I somehow had ended up there and really enjoyed it. And I just thought it was funny that I had gone when I was in New York and sort of made that effort. But when it opened in LA, yeah, I went like once. And then it closed. So he opened a lunch counter there in Far East Plaza, and he opened an actual bona fide Pok Pok with the bar and all that stuff nearby in Chinatown. And both of those restaurants folded very quickly. Hmm. It's odd to me that Hall and Ray's has that line when we couldn't keep Pok Pok there.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't know what that's about. And it's true that there's tons of great Thai food very nearby in LA, in Hollywood, or what they call Thai Town. Yeah. I mean, there's so many great Thai, you know, restaurants that have been there forever, you know, since I was growing up, that are institutions and deserve to be supported. Yeah. And, you know, mostly are run and chefed by Thai people and a lot of women, which is great. But it's kind of odd to me that in this context of LA, someone like Andy Ricker couldn't kind of like make it work.
Good, yeah, it didn't
work. When Hall and Ray's is just this runaway. But I mean, fried chicken, I mean, it's pretty good all the time.
It's true. It's true. I mean, so I guess that's I'm going to do my, that's a good segue into, you know, into my next question or a next question in my questionnaire. If you could have one food for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Does it count if I say a baguette with pâté on it and cornichon?
You can answer that question however you feel. There are no qualifiers.
A crusty baguette with pâté and cornichon is like the food that I like really love.
A different
when
way
I was
to
a
ask
kid.
The question is like, what's your perfect food? Right.
That's just something that I've always loved that has like very strong both emotional triggers and also connections to all the food that I still love, you know,
sure.
And it's like the thing that you could kind of riff off of, but it's something that I really treasure because it's something that my parents introduced me to. You know, my mother had lived in France, but you know, the idea of these weird little pickles and like pâté and bringing that for lunch, like I was made fun of a little bit on the schoolyard for that. But so having that experience but still loving it and just the vinegar bite of that. And like, that's why I think Ken and Michelle, one of the reasons why they asked me to talk to you at their bookstore was because like, I don't know, something about like super acidic foods I've always loved. And so, you know, it's something like I carry with me, you know, still. So yeah, that's kind of it. And anchovy paste.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Totally. Did you cook a lot as a kid? Did your parents cook?
My parents cooked, yeah. And so anchovy paste, I made this dressing when I was a kid, which was basically like a mayonnaise made from a yolk with, you know, Dijon and the egg yolk. And we had this great, it was a tiny little craftsman house on a double lot, and we gardened a lot. In fact, my family was on the cover of the gardening section of the LA Times when that existed.
Wow.
Yes. And it's a photograph. It looks very American Gothic, like it was the 1980s, but it could have been the 1880s. But we all had plots that we tilled, and this amazing, when my parents
like,
found out.
Like ad, each of you in the family? Like you had your own?
Me and my sister Elizabeth and my mother and my father, we had four little raised beds.
Wow.
In addition to this huge yard. And when my parents saw the ad in the newspaper for this house, it said orchard. A one-armed judge had built this house in the teens. It was on this little cul-de-sac near the corner of Melrose and Western. And all the two little cul-de-sacs and all the houses there had been built in the teens. His wife was a horticulturalist, and she had planted all these trees. 100-foot, by the time we moved there in the 80s, all this stuff was perfect maturity. 100-foot avocado tree, sapote,
what?
Mulberry, three kinds of grapes, persimmon, yeah, pineapple, guava. Like, it was this incredible place to grow up, fig, citrus.
So this, to me, what you're describing is like, that is what would get me to leave New York and move to LA. Everybody's like, you would love it in LA. And I'm like, I drive through Los Angeles and I drive through the neighborhoods and I'm just like, oh God, I can't, I don't want to live in a place where I have to drive everywhere. I don't, you know, and like, yeah, I get the farmer's market thing, but like, we do okay. And like, we get some pretty good food here and I preserve a lot of stuff from the summer for the winter. But like, having that kind of shit growing on my property, I would love. When I was a kid, we had a family friend who lived in San Juan Capistrano and had two avocado trees. And when avocados were ripe, they would FedEx us every week a box of avocados. So I remember as a kid, like, my dad would come home from his office with this box that was, and we would eat avocados only for like a week because they were all ripe at the same goddamn time. We get like 30 of them.
Yep. I mean, that's the story. I mean, our avocado tree was one of my chores because the squirrels would get to them and eat them. In fact, the avocados were strange. I mean, I don't know what cultivar they were, but they had the dark, wrinkly skin of like a Haas, but they had these large pits and there wasn't much flesh, and the squirrels would get to them and like eat half of them, and then they would drop from the tree. And then there would be a bunch of little avocado trees sprouting up at the base. So it was my job to pick up that detritus, but then also just garbage bags full of these things that we would give away to people. But you couldn't really like fan it out or whatever.
Right.
But a friend of mine, a guy I know and admire, decided to interview me for a story. His name is John Birdsall. He's a great food writer for Bon Appetit, about the history of avocado toast, because in talking to people like me who grew up in LA, realized for us, this was, before it was a fad food, it was just something, it was an after school snack.
Right.
You know, and so
you had to put the avocados on everything.
You had to put them on your
Cheerios. You put them on your toast. You put them on
chips, them on English muffins, whatever, and a little Cavender's Greek seasoning on top. It's great. My dad claims that he would broil the English muffin a second time after he put the avocado back in, but I cannot believe that he did that to me. I hope that he didn't do that, and I don't specifically remember that. But so anyway, there was dill in the yard, and I used to make this salad dressing with anchovy paste and basically make, you know, a mayo. But with dill and Roquefort, and vinegar and lemon, and I called it Richard's Famous Salad Dressing, and I made a little label. And
I mean, the fancy food show is coming up.
So yeah, I mean, never a serious cook, and so, but I mean, my interest in food and writing about food definitely came through, you know, kind of cooking at home, cooking for friends, and then doing weird, like, fermentation and pickling projects as well. But, you know, my casual interest in food is analogous to my casual interest in, you know, cooking. I think it's something we should do.
Yeah. Do you have any more books in the works?
I'm working on a book right now, a totally different kind of book that's about drink. It's going to be about boba.
What's boba?
On the East Coast, generally people say bubble tea.
Ah, yes.
So tapioca balls, the milk tea from
very
Taiwan.
Very familiar with bubble tea. Never heard it called boba.
Yeah. I don't think this has been announced or anything like this, but yeah, we're doing a book. I'm doing this book with the Boba guys. They have a bunch of stores in San Francisco and New York, and they just opened in LA too.
Cool.
But it'll be the first like major English language book about this phenomenon that is huge in Asia and, you know, kind of came to America as a fad in the 90s. I mean, I certainly remember it, you know, being around, but they've kind of grown it up and they have this new take on it. And it's, I mean, hopefully the book will speak to like this huge audience of people.
So my question for you, since you're writing a book about this,
is
do you need the special machine that puts the fully flat piece of plastic on top of the cup to make this stuff properly? That is my favorite thing about going to those places, because that is the only place that machine is in use that I'm aware of. You could use it for so many things, but the only place I've ever seen it is in bubble tea.
We're going to have to deal with that in the book. Yeah, the hardware at home.
Yeah.
Good question, Harry. I don't have an answer.
Hard hitting here on Feast Your Ears, folks. Do you have any pets?
Yes, I have a dog named Jubal, and named after the first musician in the Bible, or the Torah, what I know is the Old Testament. He is a 13-year-old wire-haired fox terrier who used to be on my business card, but I just printed a new one. His legs are giving up, but he still likes to, you know, quiver at the foot of the table and lick the plate after dinner, so he's still having a lot of joy in his life.
I bet.
Yeah, I know. He's a very well-loved dog. I mean, he's sort of split between me and my parents. My parents, you know, are still in L.A., and they actually...
Are they still in the same house?
No. We left that house. There was a major earthquake in 1994.
Yes.
The Northridge.
We hear about those things here. We have not experienced them in New York.
It was big. The chimney came in, the floorboards, and all of a sudden we were going to leave that area. That and the riots. So then we lived somewhere else. Then my parents moved to Pasadena, which I contend is maybe where I should have grown up. Seems very idyllic out there. I had never got to go to Pasadena when I was a kid. But yeah, they recently moved to a house that's like 2 miles from my house. And so we cart the dog back and forth, and he is like turning into an eccentric old man who knows how much everybody loves him. Yeah.
I mean, that seems like a pretty LA thing, right? I mean, you know.
Yeah.
I've seen
the pampered dog?
I mean the old man who knows how much like everybody loves him, right? Like the, you know, sort of kvetchy, like.
Yes, right. Yeah, he's kind of that.
Yeah. Do you have any kids?
No. No.
If you
this is the
dinner,
questionnaire, huh?
It is. If you could have dinner with anyone, who would it be? Could be someone you've had dinner with previously. Could be someone you've never had dinner with. Could be someone alive. Could be someone dead. Could be fictional.
Yeah. That's a really fantastic question. You know, I think that I would love to have dinner with Thomas Jefferson. I just think that
my daughter would say the same thing.
I think, yeah, it comes from a childhood, you know, like, I did do a book report or you know, like, elementary school profile on Thomas Jefferson, but I think it was, like, Kennedy said something about when he had, like, all the heads of state at the White House once, he was like, never before has there been such a collection of intellect at this table since Thomas Jefferson sat here alone to eat, you know? So, you know, and he played the violin, and obviously some things have come out about what he did recently that I would love to nail him on.
Yeah. Yeah,
certainly. He's a confusing guy.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, I often wonder about what those sorts of conversations would really be like and how much you would even be able to communicate, right? Because your point of reference, although being human and being American, the point of reference is super different.
We'd
just
have to
in
try.
Terms of how, yeah, I mean, it'd just be very, it'd be fascinating to try to get past the, like, either oh my God, you're from the past and you just showed up here in the future, or the, like, you're from the future and you just showed up in the past.
Well,
right?
Hopefully,
like,
he would open some of his nice French wines that he got, you know,
hope,
during his
yeah.
trips, and I could see what that whole thing is like, because
yeah.
nobody knows that either.
Yeah, that's true. He was one of the few that was drinking a lot of wine
yeah.
at the time.
No, definitely.
Sure.
I mean, he got to do it all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. Table for one or dinner party?
What's my preference?
Yeah.
Like, who am I?
Yeah.
I'm a dinner party.
All right.
But I love eating alone, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, when I'm out, I love eating, like, at the bar by myself.
Yeah.
I think that that is, like...
Do you have,
like,
a particularly memorable solo eating experience that you've had recently?
I guess not. I don't eat so much by myself. You know, like, I have a live-in girlfriend, and... we go to the Hollywood Farmers Market once a week.
Yeah,
we used
sure.
to get 2 CSAs. And so,
yeah.
like, we do a lot of cooking at home, you
yep.
know. And to an extent, I work at home. And so I'm able to do that.
Yep.
But no, I just, like, I think sitting at the bar and having the bartender right there in front of you
yep.
is my favorite way to eat. Because also, it's not about this person, like, checking in on you or doing that in the right way. It's just there's this more fluid kind of relationship between
yeah.
the service and yourself. And there's, like, different ways that you can kind of telegraph what you might want or that you are totally okay, you know. And I like that sort of dance of service. And
yeah.
and also, I just love, like, taking in a meal by myself and... people watching, I guess.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, I love the people watching aspect of it. I always am struck by the difference in pacing when you eat alone.
Right.
Both on, like, a personal level and also on a, because there's no conversation happening, I find I need to slow myself down.
From consuming too quickly?
Yeah, from
yeah.
eating too fast because there's no talking to
totally.
Kind of break up the eating.
No, when I'm at home, like, the actual eating part will go crazily fast. I had a great meal alone recently at Petit Trois, which is a restaurant in L.A., a Ludo Lefebvre restaurant. It's like the Parisian bistro style.
Yeah.
And they have great butter and baguette and pate and cornichon and all these things and wonderful cocktails. And then it was like one cocktail, then like the crazy burger with like this like really rich like sauce on it and amazing fries. I think maybe it's like beef tallow or something like that, but they're great French fries. and like one glass of wine. And I was like, that was the perfect like indulgence slash moderate. And I just like being in control, you know, like I'm like, you know, I can kind of indulge to the exact extent that is proper maybe. Yeah. Without the sort of like lingering, but when I'm at home, I'm just like Mr. Poppin' bottles and like, I'm like, let it all rage on.
Yeah.
And I love cooking for people and yeah.
This episode is brought to you by Pop M, a unique shop teeming with vibrant colors and awash in pop art, located in Littleton, New Hampshire. Its alternative cafe marries healthy and fresh with luscious and decadent treats. At Pop M, indie brands and local artists mingle, bringing quality and hot-off-the-press style. Follow Pop M at popm.nh. This episode is also brought to you by New York Mutual Trading, the premier Japanese food, alcoholic beverage, and restaurant supply specialist. Mutual Trading is the Japanese food authority, true to the heart in upholding genuine Japanese food traditions and progressive in exploring new ways to provide innovative restaurant supplies and services. They import, export, distribute, and manufacture the top brands for retailers and food service customers nationwide. Learn more at nymtc.com.
So I was recently thinking about this thing, and I had read something about it a couple of years ago. Somebody had written a sort of sociological take on people ordering at a table, and how, like, what happens. And someone, I think, had done an experiment where, like, what happens if you start at different people at the table, what they order.
Sure.
Because people change what they're going to order. Like, when you look at a menu and you're with a group of people, you're like, all right, in your brain, you're like, all right, I'm going to have the monkfish. And I'm going to have, like, a side of broccoli and mashed potatoes or whatever the options are. And you're like, and I'm going to have a red wine. Like, you figure it all out. And then...
And then Steven orders the monkfish.
Exactly.
And you're like,
so what's
your
take on that?
Well, then it's like, oh, is Steven going to think I'm biting his style? I think that it does affect me. I think that's probably one of the reasons why I do like eating alone, where I'm just like, I can kind of, like, dial this in to the maximum extent.
I've recently decided to try to not let that stuff affect me, and I recently went out to dinner with two friends, and we each ordered the exact same thing.
Three guys.
Different drinks. One guy was drinking beer, one person was drinking red, I was drinking rosé, but we ordered two appetizers to split, and we each ordered a burger exactly the same.
But maybe it's key that they were three different drinks.
Maybe. Good point.
Because if Joey ordered the rosé, you know, by the time it got around to you, if you were third.
But I've been trying, and it, you know, it comes up in certain situations, not in others. I mean, when I'm meeting with my family, I feel like it doesn't come up.
Yeah.
When we go out, I mean, just the way that my wife and I end up ordering food together, and our kids, and like figuring out who's going to share what, right? Because with kids, they're not going to finish their food anyway. So like, you sort of rearrange what you're ordering for that. But when I go out with other people, I think I've been trying recently to be like, okay, what do I want?
Right.
And I try to stick with it, pretty much. Unless someone throws a curveball and they're like, oh, do you want to split this and this? Or like, but I've been trying to be like, I'm going to get this thing because I decided I want a burger with blue cheese and a salad. Like, that's what I want. And I don't care that the two people that ordered before me ordered the same thing. I'm still going to get that because that's what I decided I wanted.
Well, oftentimes, I mean, two things. Oftentimes when I'm out to dinner with friends, I haven't even looked at the menu by the time the server has asked for the third time if we're ready to order. You know, like it's just like I've had the cocktail or whatever, I'm catching up. And then I have to make the split decision if I'm in an unfamiliar restaurant. That affects things.
Yeah.
But also, obviously, this excludes like a lot of what I like to eat when I'm eating with people, which is, you know, a lot of Asian food where like you're like kind of meant to split things.
Yeah.
You know, like if you're eating Chinese food, generally, like
if everybody orders the same dish, then you have a table that
you're dead.
Is full.
Yeah, forget about
it. It's not interesting and it's not the reason you go there.
And sure. I mean, that's a fun way of, I think, eating together that makes sense because I think it's, in a sense, designed for that. But in this kind of like, whatever, if I'm ordering my thing and you're ordering your thing, I know last night I hadn't looked at the menu, you know, and I'd been there and it was like eight people, friends and new friends, and too much talking and catching up. And then all of a sudden it was time to order. And And my friend Patrick was sitting to my right, and he ordered first. And I was like, yeah, I haven't even. And then it was going to skip over to my friend, my new friend, Brendan. And he was like, fried chicken sandwich. And he was like, bro, fried chicken sandwich. And I was like, that sounds great. Yeah. You know, like, it's like, how many other things well, do I want
and,
more?
Yeah. And are you, I mean, I, you know, the likelihood that it's going to come and you're going to like taste it and be like, oh God, this ruined my whole night.
Yeah.
This delicious
once again, the fried chicken sandwich
ruined my whole night. Like, that's very unlikely.
It's one of those things that generally goes down pretty easy, you know? You're not usually like, I really wish I hadn't eaten that fried chicken sandwich. Wish I hadn't let it sit there so long, but...
Do you have, you know, I mean, like, this is, you know, this is sort of a, like, loaded question, but if someone was going to be in L.A., where would you tell them to go above all else? Like, if they, you know...
I mean, this is, I know my answer to this, and I think that a lot of people would disagree with me on this, and I'm like, you know, people, because I write about food, consider me an authority on this for some reason, and they shouldn't, because it has to do with tons of other stuff,
yeah.
And more about, like, what we're talking about, and, but there's a restaurant called Musso and Frank in Hollywood, it was opened in 1919, and it's, like, red leather booths and exposed wood, and, you know, dimly lit, and that's where Chaplin used to sit, and, you know, that's where Faulkner got drunk when he was writing screenplays, and there's the bartender who did magic tricks for me when I was a kid, because I've been coming here for special occasions, and you get the martini in the small old-fashioned glass with the dimpled metal sidecar and glass carafe, and it's just, you cannot get that anywhere else in LA, and,
yeah.
And it's the iconic experience of going out that is obviously... like a mid-century, you know, kind of throwback. But to me, it's an ultimate, like, iconic dining experience in L.A. And it's in the middle of the worst neighborhood ever, you know? Like, it's on Hollywood Boulevard. You know, just knickknacks for miles. And then you walk in through this little door, and it doesn't look like much. And then you're in, Orson Welles said, going to Musso's is like being in the womb. And so I recommend doing that because you're going to have some stiff drinks. You know, you're going to spend a little bit more money than you might. You're going to eat like a big old hunk of meat. Is it the best ever? I've never been to like Peter Luger's. Like, you know, it's not like that experience, but I think there's something a little bit more. It has the sort of like, you know, sheen of like mystery and old Hollywood that I recommend people getting a little dose of when they're in L.A.
Cool.
Yeah.
I will take that under advisement for the next time. Next time I'm there, what is your favorite kitchen tool?
My knife that I... It's a Bob Kramer knife that is sold at Williams-Sonoma. It's not like a Kramer.
Yeah.
But I met Bob Kramer and I started talking to him.
What a great guy.
He was so... And he sent me a knife. And I treasure it and I use it every single day. So yeah, like... Shout out to Bob. Like,
yeah, Bob's a great guy. I've done some events with him at the kitchen. Yeah,
he and his wife Leanne were so sweet. You know, I met them.
She's killer.
She's
yeah.
amazing. Yeah, and I was like, please adopt me. But yeah. So yeah, and I always think of them and his, you know, generosity when I use it, which is every day.
Yeah. How do you take your coffee?
I make my coffee like my mother does, which is it's a Melitta pour over, but she's been doing that since way before that was
a cool thing.
Yeah. But always when we would travel, if we were in a hotel somewhere, which we weren't very often, but I remember that she would take her coffee and her number 4 filters and it would be like ground from Melitta and she would make her coffee that way. And then with honey and cream, half and half. I use agave, but yeah, I drink my coffee like my mom.
Nice.
Yeah.
What is your what's your biggest pet peeve related to food?
I don't know that I have one. I mean, I don't know. I grew up in a very kind of like traditional household. That's the best word that I can think of to describe it. But you know, it's dinner every night, set the table. We went to Episcopal Church every Sunday, so we would say a prayer. Speak when spoken to, sir and ma'am. There was a lot of formality and ritual around the dinner, and one of two prayers was usually recited. And the formality of that, and then everyone's at the table until it's time to be excused, like, honestly, I just can't shake it, you know? I'm like, don't get, you know, it's like, this dinner's not over yet. Like, I find myself, so I don't know if that's a pet peeve, but it's like, I like that it's, like, taken very seriously, and that there is, like, a length to it, and, like, you know, like, there's something kind of, like, I mean, without the speak when spoken to part of it, if you take that out, but it's like, we're going to spend some time together.
Sure.
And we're not going to, like, rush through anything, and it's not like everyone has to stay forever, but, you know, I want it to fill the evening, and, like, so I think, I don't know, I guess my pet peeve would be, like, not embracing that.
Yeah.
Like, don't start doing the dishes now or whatever. Sure. You know, don't turn on the appliance, you know, unless it's whipping some cream or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're just going to, like,
respect the moment.
Exactly.
To be together, to sit together, to eat, to,
Yeah, the ritual of that, and that there are all these things that happen leading up to that, and then, like, this is the moment where the real thing happens, which is, like, we're going to be people hanging out for a long time, talking about whatever's on our minds.
Do you still say any kind of prayer when you eat?
Only when I'm at my sister's house, which, much to my surprise, she started going to church with her son, who's now 7, and they say a prayer in 2 languages, and...
What's the second language?
Spanish.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he goes to a language immersion school down the street from his house in Echo Park, and and he always corrects my pronunciation.
So I mean, I grew up Jewish. The sitting down to eat was always super important. I mean, we were those, like, you know, those, like, I mean, I talk to friends who don't live in New York, and they're like, God, you New York people, your kids go to bed so late. I mean, when I was a kid, both my parents worked, and we would often not sit down to dinner until, like, 8. But we always sat down to dinner,
right?
As a family, unless somebody was out of town, unless a parent was out of town. And so that was always really important to me, but prayer was never a part of it. And my wife and I, the past couple of years, started spending Memorial Day weekends with a family, a large extended family, whom we are friends with part of, but then now friends with all of them. And the matriarch of that family is 95 years old and is very prayer conscious, prayer based. I mean, the Lord is very important to her.
Mm-hmm.
And so at the meals at her house, there is often a grace said. And so we picked up this grace from them that we now say with our family, but we also say itadakimasu, which is what they say in Japan before they eat. And so we have this kind of funny thing where, like, our kids are learning this thing that's, like, quasi-religious. I mean, the Lord is mentioned and stuff, but it's not, like, you know, we're kind of a-religious people.
Right.
But then we also have this thing that comes out of more of, like, a, like, Shinto almost, or Shinto or Buddhist kind of, like, Japanese cultural thing.
Yeah.
And we kind of, like, stick them together, and that's, like, how we say grace before meals.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I think it's, like, that seems like it's just imbuing it with something where, you know, you're taking this very seriously.
It's like an om at the beginning of a yoga class,
this is,
right?
Like, when we come together.
Yeah.
Like, we're going to, exactly. So acknowledging that and kind of, you know, putting whatever symbolism that makes sense to you on that, I think is cool.
Yeah.
I'm cool with that.
Okay. Do you have a favorite book? Doesn't have to be food related.
Yeah, I mean, I always used to say Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, just because the prose is insane and, like, the research that went into that book, but it's so violent. I don't really, you know, it's not very on-brand for me. But no, I think that, yeah, that's a very special book to me. And The Joy of Cooking, I guess, if it was going to be a food book.
Yeah.
And it's just, like, there's always been a joy of cooking in my house, and my parents actually have marked, like, sort of annotated it with dates of things that they've made, or, you know, like, things connected to, like, feasts.
Nice.
And yeah, that book and James Beard's American Kitchen, American Cooking, I believe it's called, are, like, the 2 iconic cookbooks of my childhood that are still in my parents' house that I, like, look forward to, you know, keeping forever.
Yeah, awesome. Is there any particular, like, story or anecdote that you feel like would be a good one for Feast Your Ears that you want to tell?
I don't know. I mean, what do you think? First time I tried to make vinegar, it turned into a, like, a fruit roll up.
That's a good. We talked about that.
Yeah, we talked about that at the event. I don't know. I think that it's fun to talk about, like, embarrassing things you've done in the kitchen, because, like, the way that I got interested in food and the way that, you know, like, starting to cook when you're like out on your own or whatever, yeah. It's funny. It's almost like there's like a barrier for a lot of people. Sure. Or like still even at, you know, I'm 36 and like I go over to my friends' houses and they're like, I was nervous to cook for you. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, and it's not like I'm a chef or anything like that. I don't even really consider myself a food writer. I don't even really consider myself a writer. You know, it's just like, let's try to be real about, you know, I'm just a guy who, like, I love being cooked for, and I love cooking for people, and I generally will, like, forgive a lot. And so, I don't know, I think that whatever, insert embarrassing story about, like, first time I tried to make vinegar, it, like, totally botched it, or just, like, the weird stuff, and then just, like, you know, just, like, learning how to do it is, that's not an anecdote at all, but is important.
Well, but, I mean, you know, like, the fun is in the search kind of thing, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, like, part of it is the journey, and, like, getting there and learning from doing and like and making your own kind of mental notes. I mean, you know, I mean this may, you know, this may or may not be a relevant anecdote, but yesterday, a couple days ago, I made my second batch of homemade tempeh.
Mm-hmm.
And this batch was way better than the first one because I sort of took some mental notes during the first one and like some things that didn't go the way I wanted them to. It was too much liquid. Some other bacteria maybe, like the temperature was a little bit messed up, and like the second batch came out amazing.
Mm-hmm.
So like that definitely was like the first one wasn't great and I really wouldn't have wanted to serve it to anybody. And my kids looked at it and they were like, ugh, I don't want to go near that. And then the second one, at least my daughter tasted the batch I made today, but she didn't like it. Whatever. Kids use food as a lever. That's their problem.
Sure. But yeah, I think that doing that is important. And like from any fermentation projects, like what's fun about it is that it's dynamic and that it requires attention and readjusting and that it's not the same every time.
Yeah.
And that's cooking.
Yep.
Yeah.
Totally. Where can people find you on social media?
I am at Richard Parks. So it's my name, Richard Parks, except instead of an I, there are two E's. For no damn good reason other than there are too many Richard Parks in the world.
as previously mentioned.
Yeah, I guess I should find Richard Parks 3 is available.
Website?
HelloThisIsRichard.com.
Cool.
Yeah.
And tell me about your podcast.
Well, I'm doing one for work that I can't tell anyone about
because
I work for a big company.
Secret.
But, I have a couple episodes of a food podcast that I've labeled it as gastro comedy. They're old but ancient. I recommend you check it out. Richard's Famous Food Podcast, named after the salad dressing I made when I was a kid.
Do you have the recipe? You basically gave us the recipe.
I haven't brought it up in the podcast yet. They're just a couple. It's kind of a zany. There's a lot of original music, a lot of sound design, and some attempts at jokes and other kinds of humor in there. So yeah, check that out. And then I record this thing called Live at the Astro with my friend David. We eat breakfast once a week at a diner in LA and record it. No plan.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Richard, for joining me on Feast Your Ears.
It was an absolute pleasure to have this. Is this a growler?
Sure. Yeah, a growler.
Folks, we got through a growler during this, so thanks
here
for your patience.
A sweaty Saturday afternoon in Brooklyn.
Underneath the BQE.
Today's recipe is for a ginger shiso shrub. When I was in LA back in May, I made this to serve at the book event where Richard interviewed me. You can make this in a hotel bathroom. I did. Take two large knobs of ginger, wash them, slice them thin, right into a quart container. Add 15 to 20 shiso leaves torn into small pieces. Cover the ginger and shiso with sugar. Close the container and shake it every half hour for a few hours so that the sugar starts to dry out the flavors. Pour apple cider vinegar or white wine vinegar in to fill the container and continue to shake it and let that infuse and dissolve all the sugar into the vinegar for at least 18 hours. Strain out the solids, mix it with shochu, about one part shrub to 4 to 5 parts shochu, and serve over ice. The people in Los Angeles liked it, and I'm sure you will too. Thanks for listening to Feast Your Ears today. Big thank you to David Tatasciore for engineering this show. You can find Feast Your Ears, as well as lots of other great shows, at heritageradionetwork.org, on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. Please take a moment to like the show, if you do in fact like it, on any of those platforms. And you can reach out to me if you have any questions, harry@thebrooklynkitchen.com. And you can follow me on social media, @thefoodballer. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Heritage_Radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.